So, Ben, what I want to ask you is tell me a little bit about your background. Now, of course, Mark and I knew you from the East Timor Action Network. And now, of course, as someone who collaborates and works and sometimes just publishes your own articles with, like, where have you been published in Covert Action Quarterly?
Actually, Counterpunch is the place where it has a website where my stuff has appeared a fair amount. And then in the print edition of Counterpunch and a few other journals.
That's great. That's great. So tell me, what was it like making the transition from working on with the East Timor Action Network? What happened with that, and how did that sort of evolve into what you're working on now? Or what happened with the East Timor struggle?
Well, East Timor was occupied by the Indonesian military for 24 years. They finally got their independence after a vote on August 30th, 1999. I was there with many other internationals as an observer of the vote, which was supervised by the UN. The East Timorese overwhelmingly voted for independence, but then the Indonesian military and its militia flunkies cracked down and killed a lot of people, drove a lot of people into the mountains and over the border into West Timor. But finally, after the next 2 years or so, well, actually, the next couple of months, the Indonesian military pulled out. And now East Timor is independent. So they're in a tough position economically. They're the poorest country in Asia. But the military is out. The Indonesian military is not out of Aceh, which people have suddenly been reading about. There's been very little coverage of what's going on there. And in the coverage of the tsunami, which has obviously devastated Aceh, actually the earthquake that caused the tsunami devastated Aceh, and then the waves did further damage. But the Indonesian military has been there for over two decades, and unfortunately they've been doing there what they did in East Timor, fighting an independent struggle by cracking down on the civilian population, waging a war that uses systematically uses rape, torture, extrajudicial executions, and there are very few outside observers or journalists. It's been closed off to journalists. So one of the things that people I've worked with for a long time has been doing in the last couple of weeks is trying to force the sort of public discussion and the media coverage to also address the history of the Indonesian military there, which is, it's always an ongoing problem with activists that we're trying to get the corporate media to have a broader focus than this week. And of course, in the editing process, generally anything that's remotely critical of the U.S. government somehow gets cut out. So given that the U.S. has always supported the Indonesian military, and there's ExxonMobil has huge liquid natural gas refineries in Aceh, so that's the direct economic connection that the U.S. government is supporting their quote-unquote Western interests. You know, they're not my interests. They're not the interests of anybody in the U.S. I know, but they're the interests of Exxon and Bush and his friends. So that's kind of a link to having gone to Haiti and seen the devastation there, and kind of been working on that a bit in the last year, because to me, what the U.S. has supported in Aceh is very similar to what it's supported in Haiti, which is just sort of a, you know, kind of horrific military repression that's putting the screws to the poorest of the poor for the interests of a small number of rich people. In Haiti, John Bertrand Aristide, who's an overwhelmingly democratically elected leader, was forced out February 29th, 2004. And the U.S. supported a systematic campaign to get him out. They backed a group coalition that got a lot of money dumped into it from Washington called the Group of 184, and it included, unfortunately, newspapers and even human rights groups that got a lot of money from USAID and the State Department to systematically demonize Aristide. And also connected to that were these paramilitaries that came over from the Dominican Republic and wound up freeing all these death squad killers that just in the last couple of years had been put in jail by these very courageous Haitian lawyers and survivors of death squad atrocities who testified against these butchers and put them behind bars, and now they're all free in the last year thanks to this project that Washington sponsored there. And so it's, you know, it's a really grim situation there now, and there's not a lot of accurate information in the Western press about it. There, I would give two websites. There's a website called HaitiAction.net. There's another one that has very good information that's perhaps a little easier to read. That's run by the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. I'll check at the break, but I'm pretty sure it's IJDH.org. It's run by a lawyer named Brian Kincannon, who was one of the international lawyers working with Haitian lawyers that put away these death squad people I referred to earlier.
Well, I tell you what, we'll post some of these links up on a web page up on indiebay.org as we post about today's broadcast. So that will be exciting, and that will be there on indiebay.org. I wonder if we could back up a little bit just for listeners. And, you know, maybe try to give a little bit of sort of a background of Haiti. It's, you know, it's got a real troubled history as, you know, a colony and, you know, now a territory. And so what is it about that Haiti never really seemed to gel in the sort of post-colonial era? It's always had a lot of civil war, a lot of strife. Maybe you could fill us in a little bit about some of that.
Sure. Well, they just had their 200th anniversary of independence. It was the first independent black republic. They fought off the French. They kicked the French out, and they've been paying for it ever since. It was actually, I just only realized the other day, it was the first act of U.S. foreign aid was to assist the French in attempting to put down the independence struggle in Haiti in the very beginning of the 19th century. Actually in the 1800s, the French imposed reparations for Haiti's freedom. So in other words, the Haitian people paid off millions and millions of dollars to compensate the French for lost property, that property being the slaves that the French used to have in Haiti. That's
what a history.
Yeah. And actually, that's one of the things that Jean-Bertrand Aristide was addressing in the last few years that particularly incensed the French government and French elites. Aristide wanted restitution for that debt, because ever since the 1800s, Haiti, which by all rights was resource rich, should be a self-sustaining independent country. It has been the poorest country in the hemisphere. The way the Western U.S. media discusses Haiti, you would think that this is just the case because, as my Haitian activist friend says, it's in our genes somehow. We're poor, we're barbaric, we can't get it together. Well, no, that's not at all true. The country's been exploited by the U.S. and France for 200 years, and you know, it's always been a source of incredibly cheap labor. The U.S. Marines went down in the beginning of the 20th century, and since then, we've been supporting repressive regimes there, and we systematically supported death squads that forced out Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide first in 1991. That was initiated under Bush the Elder. And now Bush the Younger, when he got in 2000, his administration just made it a project to get rid of Aristide, and they did. And now Aristide is in South Africa. And there's been this systematic demonization. And there's I think it's galling how incredibly racist so much of the even kind of liberal discourse on, if you can call NPR liberal, but NPR and the other mainstream outlets in discussing Haiti, there's always this tone about, oh, this barbaric country, and oh, who knows why all these people are fighting and they're at war. And it's always these reporters go in and they sort of like talk to a bunch of elites. And lately, in the last couple of months, a lot of stories have been coming out where reporters talk about how there's this yearning for the days of Papa Doc Duvalier, the notoriously brutal dictator. Well, yeah, there's yearning amongst these French and English-speaking elites, that which are the only people that most reporters talk to, aside from a very few exceptions. So, you know, it's like the Africa of the Western Hemisphere. It's the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, but it's, you know, one of the most African countries, in that the vast majority is extremely poor, but also extremely Afro-Haitian, in that, you know, they're a very small number of light-skinned elites. So when I was there for 2 weeks in the start of December, and it was just it hit me very hard how much that was the case. And you know, when I came back and I looked at the way people talk about Haiti, it really got to me.
Was Haiti one of the original sort of outposts, as it were, getting back to the history thing a little bit? Was that one of the original outposts for the British East India Company? Is that how a lot of the folks who, you know, are descended of the original, I guess, implanted inhabitants, were they affiliated at all with that whole triangle of sugar, rum, sugar trade that was going on in the British East India Company?
Well, the British were in, you know, I'm not an expert on the early history, but they were in the other half of the island, which became the Dominican Republic. And Toussaint Louverture was sort of pull them into the struggle against the French, and he was a very savvy military tactician. So he did have contact with the British, and the British were there. I can't answer that question right offhand.
Well, that's okay. That's fine. It was just a kind of a
you
curiosity.
Can penalize me if you
want. No, it was kind of a curiosity of mine. But clearly, the Dominican Republic was, you know, involved in all that, and much of that, the Caribbean, was being affected by that kind of trade that was going on, slave trade, back in the day. So, anyway, getting back forward to now, to the. The Bush team comes in office, and after all this history, they decide for sure they want to get Aristide out, the ouster of Aristide. And in your research and in the people that you talk to, can you point our listeners to, or can you discuss something that maybe really pertains to that, to the Bush plans to undermine Aristide?
Well, Aristide's big crime in the eyes of the Bush crew was that he wanted to increase the minimum wage, and he wanted to make things better for the poorest of the poor. And in fact, his the slogan that Lavalas, which is the party that he started and is still the biggest political party in Haiti, used was from misery to poverty with dignity. And it's very ironic that I saw just the other day, I saw something in the mainstream press where some incredibly arrogant blowhard was writing about how if only we could get the Haitians to move from misery to poverty with dignity without conceding that this was something they're working on themselves until the U.S. and forces backed by the U.S. Cracked down on Lava Lots on so many fronts and forced Aristide out. And now, since February 29th, 2004, nobody knows how many people have been killed. But I talked to political prisoners in several jails. There were people who'd been put in jail for having dreadlocks, because that's associated with Lava Lots. With a party, it's that bad, and there's just arbitrary detention. People who've been in jail for months and months who haven't seen a judge. In fact, there's a CD that you have of music by a woman that the Haiti Action Committee is launching a campaign for, along with other political prisoners, named So-Ann, who is a prominent Lava Lots organizer. And she was arrested by U.S. Marines, who busted into her house in May when the Marines were still there. Since then, the Marines have pulled out, and now there's a kind of a UN coalition occupation there, including Brazilians and Chileans. But when the Marines arrested her on entirely specious charges, they've never come up with the authorities have never come up with really coherent charges against her. They broke into her place in the middle of the night, which is a violation of the Haitian Constitution, which was put in place after Duvalier was forced out because the death squads used to do things like this. The Marines blew open her door with a grenade, and they put hoods on everyone in the house, including her kids and her grandkids. Her grandkids were there. And they shot two dogs that were in the yard. They were like family dogs. So these Marines were just loaded for bear. You know, they were sent down there with this propaganda about these rabid thugs. You know, some of the Marines were probably, you know, ideologically anti-Lava Lots, but most of them don't know what's going on, just like most of the troops in Iraq don't know what's going on. And Lava Lots has been systematically demonized to the point where now when you see newspaper coverage, if anybody's killed in Port-au-Prince, there's usually a reference to Lava Lots gangs. Well, you know, the Lava Lots is like 80 to 90% of the population, maybe more. So it's the poorest country in the hemisphere, and there's these enormous slum neighborhoods where there are hundreds of thousands of people all jammed together. You know, some people are getting like two meals a week, and some of these neighborhoods are sealed off, and the police are going in and just killing people. So, of course, and there are massive amounts of guns, thanks to the U.S. So, of course, there's criminal activity. Some of these people say, we're pro-Aristide, we're pro-Lava Lots. That doesn't mean that, you know, this is Lava Lots policy to do whatever they're doing. And the other thing is that, as far as I'm concerned, if there are police or death squads coming into a neighborhood, if that happened in Texas, you know, people would be shooting back. But because these are poor Haitians, you know, we can wring our hands up here and say, oh my God, if only they'd be more Gandhian. You know, well, I find that a bit presumptuous.
Yeah, it really is. When you're faced with that kind of crisis, that kind of odds, and that history of repression, it reflects a sort of insular viewpoint for us to sit up here and, oh, everyone should just be Gandhi, you know.
Yeah, and actually, Lava Lots is overwhelmingly dedicated to nonviolent struggle. You know, they haven't embraced armed struggle, though this is the smear you get in the mainstream press. And in fact, you know, the forces that drove out Aristide are the armed forces that cracked down on civilians, that cracked down on and put in jail teachers, community organizers, doctors. members of government, members of the Lavalas government, that have been in jail without charge for months for the crime of representing the poor people and trying to work with a party that's lifting the poor up slowly but surely. So I just encourage people when they read about Haiti in the mainstream press to be very skeptical and try to read between the lines. And there's a brilliant doctor who's also a great writer named Paul Farmer, who's written a book called The Uses of Haiti, which is out from Common Courage Press. I highly recommend it. Paul Farmer also has some articles that have been published this year. He has a new book called The Pathology of Power, which is out from UC Berkeley Press in paperback. He has a couple of articles at the HaitiAction.net website, I believe. There was one in the London Review of Books that came out in about April of 2004 that's a great overview.
Nice. Well, that's a really good resource for our listeners to stay in touch with and find out more about Haiti because, you know, I have a friend at work who's very connected to people down in Haiti, and I'm one of these people who's always trying to get people to remember other things, like, for example, Sudan and maybe Colombia and all these other places around the world that are still, you know, experiencing armed struggle. And there usually is American involvement in these places as well, as we all know. And it seems like everybody's kind of forgotten about them since March of 2003. So anyway, and then this person at work is always telling me, well, really, you need to think about Haiti because, you know, I'm from there. I have friends from there. And let me tell you, that's really a place that's going off right now. And you never hear anything about it, hardly in the progressive media. It rarely gets mentioned. And so that's why I wanted to have this interview with her. Could you tell us, are there other sources out there for information? Like
Democracy Now! Has had pretty good coverage. Amy Goodman actually was on the plane with Aristide when he was coming back from Africa, or when he came back to Jamaica initially, and then he went back to South Africa. So she's had good recent interviews. I'd especially recommend an interview with a immigration lawyer who spent a lot of time in Haiti. He's coming out with a really good report. His name's Tom Griffin. You can get it on the democracynow.org website. It's Griffin, G-R-I-F-F-I-N. It was in late December. Flashpoints at KPFA Radio in Berkeley. That's flashpoints.net is a good place to go. And there's a good independent freelance journalist named Reed Lindsay, who's had some pieces in the San Francisco Chronicle and other papers, that's working really hard and very very brave and feisty and tough, and his stuff's very good.
Oh, that's so good. Well, it's so important for us to praise those good journalists when they come along, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Here on Eclectic Politique, because, you know, it's not all negative. Sometimes we can be positive here. And so Reed Lindsay is a journalist that you say is doing great work on this. And I think I've seen some of his articles. Well, that's really interesting. What about going there? Would you recommend, you know, to people that like to go and bear witness to things and help out and be activists in war-torn regions? Are just troubled regions of the world. Would you recommend people going to Haiti, and where could they find out about maybe hooking up with the right people to do that?
Well, there's a group that's very low in funds right now, but it's going to be coordinating trips by people outside again in the near future, I think. I think perhaps a little bit in a hiatus, but it's called the Haiti Accompaniment Project. And if people want to find out about it, there's an email. It's Leslie Fleming, LeslieFleming, at earthlink.net. And you can also email me. It's I can put you in touch with her if that doesn't work. I think that's it. It's my email address is BTERRALL@IGC.org.
Wow, okay, that's very brave of you to give your email out here on the air with this vast audience listening in at this time. So tell me, so that's Haiti. I think it's, you know, that was a good sort of roundup of what's going on there and how things are evolving. Do you think that, I mean, this is sort of an obvious question, or, you know, the answer is kind of obvious, but do you think, you know, with all this sort of war on terror, the hype about the war on terror, the escalation, ramp up, going back into Iraq, that it's provided a cover for other campaigns, like such as what's going on in Haiti, to try to undermine democracy in Venezuela, or try to do something else over in Haiti, or maybe back up some action, you know, on the Pakistani border, what have you? What I'm saying is this sort of an opportunistic flare-up due to problems elsewhere in the world and all the press that's being diverted to that?
Well, little enthusiasm as I had for John Kerry, when Bush was reelected, people in Haiti knew that it was going to be a green light for all the most repressive right-wing forces there. And I think the Bush administration really has an agenda that involves a war on humanity, not a war on terror. So unfortunately, we're seeing this on, you know, I think activists and people who are really serious about a sort of solidarity, you know, at home and abroad with the people on the bottom in this world, are really seeing it sort of being pushed on all fronts and taken to another level. So it's kind of hard to keep up with it. But one thing I've been thinking lately is that we're incredibly lucky up here that we're not in the kind of situations that people in Iraq and Haiti and Aceh face. And in those countries, you know, it's largely because of our government's foreign policies, as far as I'm concerned. And it's not that there are not other repressive governments that don't support wars and don't exploit their populations. But right now, the U.S. is the empire, and Washington is the empire, and they're really sort of pushing as hard as they can on all fronts. It's interesting, when you talk about the war on terror in Indonesia, the Indonesian military has been really savvy about using the rhetoric of the war on terror. There have been a lot of bombings over the last 5 years that have been carried out allegedly by various sort of right-wing fundamentalist Islamic groups. But it's sort of hard to know who is involved with all these bombings. But one thing that is pretty well documented is there's a group called Laskar Jihad that was involved in killing a lot of Christians in the Moluccas, which used to be called the Spice Islands, which are sort of in the center of the Indonesian archipelago. And Laskar Jihad was very sort of enthusiastically supported by the Indonesian military. So, you know, it's like one of the forces that's killed the most Christians in the archipelago, and here's the Indonesian military sort of a key backer. And of course in Aceh you have this incredibly repressive occupation where the Indonesian military is connected to atrocities that have been committed in proximity to ExxonMobil's operations. There's a big case against ExxonMobil that Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Had a show about in early January of this month. You know, they're talking about supporting the Bush war on terror, but it's pretty clear if you look at how many people were killed in East Timor, which is around, you know, minimum 200,000, and nobody knows how many people have been killed in Aceh, but tens of thousands easily, and in West Papua.
You just want
in West Papua, maybe 100,000. That's north of East Timor.
We're not on. No, you're dead. We're here. We're still talking with Ben Terrell at enemycombatantradio.net. And so we're doing pretty good. Listen, Ben, let me just say that let me just play devil's advocate here a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
It went for us. We're a little bit familiar with the information, what has happened in Haiti. But like my mom, for example, like somebody like my mom, how could I talk to her, you know, and convince her in a short amount of time that something's going on down in Haiti and what she should at least think about it? Do you know what I mean? In other words, what about speaking to the regular American who doesn't know anything about it? How can you tell them just briefly what's going on there?
Well, that's always a tough call when you have limited time and you have to provide all this context, which is completely different from what people have been hearing. But, you know, I think one basic thing is people are worried about our economic situation in the U.S. and budget cuts to schools and hospitals and crappy health care and rich getting richer and poor getting poorer. Well, look at how much money gets dumped into destabilizing a country like Haiti rather than just letting Haitians have their democratically elected leader and have a better standard of living. You know, it's not going to cost the majority of Americans anything, people in the U.S. anything, to let the Haitian people live a decent life. And it's also sort of a basic a question of human decency. And we've seen in the reaction to the tsunami, people giving incredible aid and being incredibly generous. I think that's a healthy impulse that everybody has, along with other impulses that the Bush administration is always manipulating to try to get people to go after people that don't look like them or people that might have different sexual orientation, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's sort of a question of basic human decency. And it's not one thing I think is very important to stress in terms of like international aid and support for the poor countries and stuff. We hear right wingers often saying, well, they're always whining, you know, they can't get it together. They want this charity. Well, it's not really charity when you've got a country that's been ripped off nonstop for 200 years. And, you know, they're some of the most exploited people in the hemisphere working in these god awful sweatshops, not making enough to survive if they have a job, you know. And so they've had the blood, sweat, and tears squeezed out of them, and they're living in misery. And people at the top in the U.S. have and in France and in Canada have profited hugely from that. So really, you know, I think it's important to think of this in terms of, you know, restitution or reparations, and just it's economic justice. It's not charity. I think that's an important point to make when we talk to people. I think too often liberals and Democrats just repeat this mantra about, you know, big-hearted do-gooder charity being an important thing, and then not taking the analysis a little further and looking at, well, what's happened in the past 10, 20, 200 years in these countries, and in the U.S. for that matter, in terms of exploitation of the poorest, that would lead us to the logical conclusion that people at the top should not be worshipped for having $100 million and getting their own reality show or whatever, you know.
Yep, you're right. There is a class issue that goes across all national boundaries and that we're all facing right now, and it's really incredible. And the class issue, it's only exacerbated. It only gets harder for working people to gain some consciousness of who they are and to fight back when they're faced with all these wars and crisis. And so that's kind of what's going on right now. And Haiti is a real troubled spot, and I hope that there's people out there listening that would like to help out and like to at least stay informed on the topic of Haiti. And one of the websites that Ben has told us about here is HaitiAction.net, and I assume that you can link to others from there. And, of course, he told us about this great interview with Tom Griffin on Democracy Now! And some other sources. So thanks so much for talking to us about that.
Can I just give two web addresses for Ace?
Sure. Yeah, I want to go back. I want to get back to Ace because we never really got to the sort of resources and websites about that and who's working on that. Now, tell us a little bit about what you know about what happened with. You don't have to if you don't want, but I know that Billy
Nesson.
Yeah, Billy Nesson and David Martinez were in Ace recently doing interviews and filming people and helping out and doing stuff. What happened with that? Billy was there for a while, and then after David left, Billy was still there, and I think he was held or something, or what happened?
Yeah, Billy actually was with GOM, the sort of nationalist liberation movement, and he spent a lot of time with a unit of GOM in Ace, and traveled with them, and did some freelance writing, and he had a very good long piece that was in the San Francisco Chronicle. I assume it's on their website, which is sfgate.com. He's had three or four that I've seen pieces. William Nesson's an independent freelance journalist, and the last one I saw was very good and had a lot of history and context and very good detail, and he's a very brave guy. Yeah.
Now, one of the things we always hear about is the number of Muslims in Indonesia. It happens to be, you know, one of the, in terms of just continents on the face of the earth, like there's a lot of Muslims there. Mm-hmm. And one thing I had heard before is that, you know, of course, the Bush administration or whoever, if they need to, if it becomes convenient for them, they'll easily kind of bring up some sort of Al-Qaeda link if they need to, right?
Yeah.
But what I've heard is that Al-Qaeda did approach some of the Muslim population there, and they kind of said, thanks, but no thanks. And could you go away before we get, you know, implicated with you? But I don't really know any hard details on that. Or any hard facts, but I was just kind of wondering, do you know anything about the type of Islam that's prevalent in Indonesia?
Yeah, it's predominantly secular. I have a lot of Indonesian friends and who've spent the majority of their lives there, and I have a friend who's an academic from the U.S. whose wife's Indonesian, who's lived there for a fair amount, has tracked this pretty closely, and in his estimation, a lot of the fighters who went to Afghanistan when the U.S. was backing the freedom fighters associated with Osama bin Laden against the forces supported by the former Soviet Union in Afghanistan, those people trickled back, you know, so some of those people are spread out throughout the archipelago, but they're not organized. As I said before, what is clear is that there are networks that are connected to the military, and the military's used Islam under the former dictator Suharto, who the U.S. helped put in power in 65-66 in a bloodbath where Amnesty International says up to 1 million people were killed. It's a lot of people. And he was like our man in the region for over two decades and oversaw this wonderful economic miracle that the business press called it. So the military's always used Islam along with everything else. And under Suharto, it was sort of just one in a variety of sort of divide and conquer tactics. So Suharto would build up one sector, and then if they got too powerful, he'd undercut them in various ways. So, it's been predominantly secular. However, my activist friends in Indonesia, since the Iraq War, are concerned that, understandably, there's a lot of movement to the right. It's just like what happens with Israel and Palestine. You know, the fundamentalist kind of right-wing Palestinian forces seem a lot more seem like a more viable option when they're when you're looking at this force that's killing a lot of people, and there's nothing else that can be. One would think, you know, like they're not. You know.
Sure, it bolsters recruitment.
Yeah.
For radical militant thinking, yeah. And participation in groups with radical militant thinking when you're under attack. It's yep. just like it's sort of a mirror of what happened here, right? 9-1-1. They use the attack. We're under attack, and that's why we got to, you know, undermine civil liberties and fight wars everywhere.
And also, just one other point, not to cut you off, but the U.S. is always talking about supporting democracy and building up alternatives to Islamic fundamentalism. Well, if you look at the history of the Middle East, U.S. foreign policy since World War II has always undercut this sort of secular left nationalist democratic forces. And that always feeds that kind of repressive right-wing counter-reaction. And so it's been the same thing in Indonesia, because as I said, in the 60s, you know, like 1 million people killed, there are a lot of leftists killed. There were a lot of just peasants. But it was just an entire generation that was, the survivors were traumatized. And then under Suharto, any kind of sort of like progressive pro-democracy forces who are either picked off or thrown in jail. And so, you know, that's the legacy of partly U.S. foreign policy in that region.
Wow, and it's had very little coverage in the mainstream press. I thought it was interesting. I don't know if you happen to see Manufacturing Consent, the movie sort of about Noam Chomsky and U.S. media. Did you get to see that?
Yeah, well, it was one of the great, the best organizing tools that the East Timor Action Network had, because it had a very good section on East Timor that's right before the intermission. So we always.
Right. And what I thought was very visual, very graphic representation there was when they had that in the basketball gym, they rolled out the coverage of the news that had been dedicated to Cambodia during
yeah.
that period.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the news coverage that was going on about East Timor, where equal numbers and what could be characterized as a genocide was actually happening. And, you know, the coverage, of course, for Cambodia, which bing, 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 went on across the whole stadium. And the coverage for Timor, you know, went bing, bing, bing. You know, that was it. You know, like really short little roll of news coverage about it. And it's just strange that Indonesia, it's not forgotten by our U.S. military interests. It's not forgotten by corporations and the oil corporations that are down there. But it seems like it's largely forgotten by the American population, the American people. You hardly ever hear Indonesia even mentioned.
You do this month, but it's sort of a question how long the window is going to be open. It was like with Haiti, you know, in the summer. When the hurricanes hit in the central region in Gonaive and about 3,000 people were killed, a lot of people drowned, all of a sudden Haiti was a big story, but you didn't get this context of what else was going on there with death squads and military repression and a coup that the U.S. arranged. So, yeah, they're brief windows where these stories are in the mainstream press.
These stories surface, and it's sort of like, wow, look at some neat hurricane pictures from Haiti, you know. that's the kind of the feeling I get anyway. Well, I wonder, we have this music here, or this CD that you brought in. You say it's from Aceh. Can you tell us?
No, it's actually
Haitian
political prisoner named. Her name is Annette Auguste, she's popularly known as Soanne. She's a very popular singer both in Haiti and the diaspora. She's performed in New York in the 80s to tens of thousands of people, actually, in Central Park in New York. Now, unfortunately, she's locked up in a jail in Port-au-Prince. I had the opportunity to meet her, real privilege, and she's a very impressive person. But she's got a tough situation, but she's not backing down like so many people on the ground in Haiti who are still supportive of Lavalas or just want to see an end to the repression that this current illegal government represents.
Well, Ben, I'd like to thank you for coming by here to Eclectic Politique, taking time out of your day to make this journey.
Was actually okay today. It wasn't so hard today.
You didn't get caught in the hail storm that happened?
No, is it that actually since the hall's been cleared up, it's been easier.
Okay, that long journey. Well, thanks for coming down to Eclectic Politique and Enemy Combatant Radio. And let's go now to what's her name?
So-Anne.
So-Anne from Haiti.
Nous sommes peuple qui gagne résistance. Nous passons journée sans manger. Nous traversons des airs à pied. Nous faisons nuit sans ne pas faire manger. Nous sommes peuple qui gagne résistance. Fair.